This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This process is happening all the time. When you pass a muddy puddle in the street, you spill a little coffee on your desk, or it's even happening on your skin. I'm talking about evaporation. And now researchers at Columbia University are working to harness this ubiquitous process as a new source of renewable energy. The scientist heading up that team is Oscar Sahin. He's a professor of biological sciences and physics at Columbia. He and his colleagues published their work in the journal Nature Communications this week, and he joins us with his prop, a prop of a little working machine, an evaporative machine here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
How powerful can evaporation be? I mean, we don't feel it happening.
Right. Evaporation is actually very powerful. It is powering many of the natural events like winds and waves, and this is happening in the atmosphere. The sun's energy hits the oceans, it evaporates water, it carries it into the air, and that in turn creates winds, for example. So you can actually expect evaporation to be at least as powerful as wind when it's done right.
Now, we hear that the hot water in powers hurricanes, for example. Is it the evaporation?
Right. The energy primarily comes from evaporation.
Wow. So you have figured out a way of harnessing the evaporation. How did you do that?
Well, we weren't actually working on this project. We were looking at bacterial spores, tiny microorganisms that typically live in the soil. A microbiologist contacted me because my lab is an expert in looking at small things, their mechanical properties, and spores are interesting for many reasons, and my collaborator wanted to study their mechanical properties. They have very interesting wrinkles on their surface, and they wanted to understand whether these wrinkles are helping the organism or not. So we made some mechanical measurements. Mm-hmm. And then we realized the spores expanding and contracting in response to changes in humidity. And that, together with our measurements, made me think they must have a lot of mechanical energy because they're so rigid. For them to expand and contract, it must carry some energy with it.
So if they expand and contract with the humidity, then you put them on tape, on some rigid,
correct.
So when they expand and contract, the tape expands and contracts.
Right, and we pattern the tape in a careful way so the tape is actually forming a wave-like shape, and it elongates and shortens in the process.
So the elongation and shortening is basically the stuff that does the work.
Correct.
And you can harness that?
Yes, if you connect it to a generator, it then produces electricity.
Wow, I've seen a wheel. I've seen a car powered with a wheel of this.
Right. So that was actually our second idea. We, along this, you know, while working on this, the device we create makes a piston-like motion. But then we thought, you know, if you can create a rotation, that could also be very useful. Then we thought about this wheel-like device. We named it Moisture Mill because it reminds us of windmills.
Right.
And it's somehow powered by moisture going into the air from an evaporating surface.
And you got it to work well enough that it actually moved the little car it was on. And it made enough electricity to light up an LED or something?
Right, it made an LED flash. This is actually not a lot of energy at this point, but we know it is possible, and this demonstration is very encouraging that we would like to spend more time working on this project.
So now it's just in the demonstration phase.
Correct.
Can you scale it up?
Well, we actually paid attention to this. The devices we created in our paper, we argued that it can be scaled to cover large areas of open water, and it would produce power proportionally. The more area you cover, the more power it might produce.
So if you put it in water that was really evaporating a lot.
Right. Actually, water in nature evaporates all the time. And in certain places, especially in reservoirs and lakes, we are losing fresh water. It evaporates into the air. And some of that actually could be saved because these devices, as they're producing power, they would be slowing down the evaporation rate and they could keep some of the fresh water in there.
So where do you go from here with this project?
Well, probably the first thing we would like to do is to make them more powerful. And there are some key problems that we would like to spend some time thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you can solve that?
I think so, but it might take a while.
Do you have to worry about the spores themselves? Will they sprout? They're spores, right?
Right. So the main purpose, biological purpose of spore is to protect bacteria from harsh conditions.
Right.
And they can actually stay in that spore form for many decades, even centuries. And that makes them very useful for technological purposes. They would not necessarily come out unless there's a trigger for that. They need nutrients, they need some chemicals, and even if they come out, they would die in place.
How did you attach the spores to all that tape there?
We actually started working with a certain chemical. That was really good, but that was really difficult to work with. We then decided, okay, maybe we should use a glue. We bought Elmer's glue, and we diluted it down, mixed with spores. That actually helped us get this device working. It is not the best thing that, you know, you can use. It actually hurts the power. It reduces the power, but it's a good demonstration with it.
Elmer's glue, and somebody spent a lot of time. Would you have billions of spores on those days?
Right, right.
A lot of graduate students working over it.
Well, I also, we work together to spend a lot of time.
It's fascinating. We'll follow what's going to happen. Thank you very much for joining us today and bringing a little demonstration. We'll have that up on our website, some of the video that we took
Thank you,
little demonstration. Ankur Sahin is a professor of biological sciences and physics at Columbia University here in New York. Ever stood in the grocery aisle staring at 15 kinds of cooking oil, wondering which is the healthiest? You've got, let's see, you got peanut oil, sunflower, safflower, and vegetable oil. What kind of vegetable is that anyway? Or you got olive oil, heard good things about that, right? But the pure olive oil or the extra virgin oil or the, how about pumice oil? Does it make a difference? Chemical processing versus mechanical processing, polyunsaturated or monounsaturated, trans fats, oil, la la. So much to choose from. Are you feeling overwhelmed? Well, give us a call. Our number 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can tweet us at SciFi. We're going to talk all about oils. And to help us sort through the oily options, we've got Tom Brenner, professor of human nutrition at Cornell. He's also a scientific advisor for the Fats of Life newsletter. Welcome, Dr. Brenner.
Thanks very much, Ira.
Give us just the fats, man, just the fats. What is cooking oil? What's it made of?
Cooking oil is a complex mixture primarily made of, what we call fatty acids. They're really esterified to glycerol, so they're triglycerides. We've heard of those as molecules in the blood, but they start out in oils. And we talk about fatty acids as long chains of carbon that are saturated with hydrogen. If we pluck out two hydrogens, we have a single double bond. That's a monounsaturate. More than one double bond is a polyunsaturate.
So why do we make all these different kinds? The monounsaturate, the poly, plucking out the bonds?
They have different biophysical properties and different biological properties in plants, which is where we get most of these oils from, but also in humans and in animals. So they have various properties. The saturated fats have high melting points. The unsaturated fats have lower melting points. And so an unsaturated fat we call oil. That's a special name for a liquid fat.
Mm-hmm. So how do omega-3, omega-6... And now I've heard about omega-9. How do they all fit in there?
Right. Well, omega-3 and omega-6 are the ones that have to be made by plants, and we can't make the basic molecule. The omega-9s we can make, although plants make lots of those. Omega-3 and omega-6 are very bioactive. Omega-3s we've all heard of with respect to the heart, but they are very important for the brain. The brain is full of omega-3. The retina is full of omega-3. That's the eye. Omega-6s are used for lots of different signaling properties. If you've ever taken aspirin or other kinds of anti-inflammatories, those drugs inhibit the metabolic processes connected to, well, both omega-6 and omega-3, but they're intended mostly for omega-6. And omega-9s are thought of as very neutral fats, and they have less strong properties metabolically.
Our phone number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, if you'd like to talk about all these vegetable oils. Or you can also tweet us at SciFry, at S-C-I-F-R-I. Can you actually tell how much of each omega type there is from the nutrition label that's on the bottle?
Some of them you can, and some of them you can't. There are some where the omegas are labeled, but there's a bit of a code. The ones that say monounsaturates, so most of them will say monounsaturates, those are mostly omega-9. The ones that say polyunsaturate, at least in vegetable oils, those are mostly omega-6. That's not the case with canola and mostly canola, maybe a little for flax, but that's mostly omega-6. So you can get an idea if you know what you're looking for.
Mm. So how do you tell them all apart? I mean, when you're shopping, should you aim for one and not the other?
Right. Well, they all have their roles, and it's not just the unsaturated versus polyunsaturated, but it's also a little bit the way that the oils have been processed. The more processed, more refined oils, refined is probably a better word, will be a little bit more suitable for high temperature applications like frying, whereas the very virgin oils tend to be better as salad oils or put onto a hot dish just prior to serving.
Mm-hmm. Are all olive oils created equal? I know there are, as you say, different kinds.
They're not created equal. Well, let's see. Standing in a supermarket, they're not created equal. They come from lots of different oils originally, and they will be extracted in a couple of different ways. One will be mechanically by simply pressing them. Olives are fruits, and so olive oil is a fruit oil as opposed to many of the other oils we talk about, like soybean, which is a seed oil. Olive oils.
Let me stop you there, Professor, because we're going to take a break. I don't want you to get into this interesting rap, and then we have to break away talking about the different kinds of olive oils. Our number 844-724-8255. We're talking about oil this hour on Science Friday. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about cooking oil and whether some types are healthier than others with my guest Tom Brenna, Professor of Human Nutrition at Cornell University. When I interrupted you, Professor, you were talking about the different kinds of olive oils. We know some are first press, second press, third press, right?
Yes, that's right. So there's a first pressings that extract oil, and then from the residue, oil will be extracted using solvents, and then that oil will be refined. So those are two different sorts of oils, olive oils that distinguish between virgin and extra virgin olive oils, which are the pressed ones and the refined ones.
You know, coconut oil got a bad rap in the past, but now it's touted as at health food sites. What's going on here?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I've been around this fat world for quite some time, and way back 30 years ago, people used to use the refined coconut oil that came into the United States as a diet to increase the cholesterol levels in their experimental animals, just because it did it very reliably. But what seems to be the case now is that was not due to the saturated fats. It was probably due to the methods of refining that were used, because we have virgin coconut oils now that do not have these properties. They have identical fatty acid profiles, that is, fatty acid compositions, but they have very different effects on cholesterol. So there's more going on than just the fats.
Is it possible to engineer all these oils, like to make the profile, let's say, of sunflower oil, basically like olive oil? We all love olive oil. We think it's healthy. Can you make all these other oils, bring them home, and make...
That's a great question, Ira. The fact is that there's a quiet revolution going on right now as industry is shifting the composition of oils from the traditional compositions to very different ones, which which are for particular applications. So that is, it is true that perhaps up to 10 years ago, sunflower oil had a certain composition. It was very, very rich in omega-6 fatty acid, but it has transitioned now so that the vast majority of it in the U.S. has a very similar composition to olive oil.
Wow.
And that has very nice properties for some for applications.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Bodega, California. Hi, Betsy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you. I'm happy to have the opportunity to ask my question. I have a sister-in-law and natural foodie-type neighbors who tell me that the expeller-pressed canola oil that I use primarily for sautéing is really dangerous, that it was developed, you know, from the rapeseed for industrial purposes, and that I really shouldn't use it. And I wonder if that's true.
Well, canola oil was developed from rapeseed. It was bred by plant breeders to reduce the level of a certain fatty acid that was thought to be less healthy. There, to my knowledge, is no strong evidence in humans that there is a very negative effect from canola oil. In fact, the scientist who came up with and gave us the omega-3, omega-6 notation, nomenclature, ate canola oil every day for lunch and lived to be about 90, I don't know, 2 or 3.
Canola is not real. There's no canola bean, is there?
No, there isn't. No. The Canadians adapted rapeseed, but they didn't want to put the label on an oil that would be the real name, which was low erucic acid rapeseed oil. That wouldn't have sold well next to next to corn oil. So they named it after themselves. They called it Canada Oil Low Acid Canola.
Canola. Wow. Well, where do you stand on butter and those kinds of oils?
Well, I don't think butter is so bad. I think it got a bad rap. Myself, butter is not just sort of bad old saturated fat. It has a lot of shorter chain fats, which are used in various processes, including for the brain. And so I think it's really in a rehabilitation phase these days.
Let's go to the phones to Lauren in Maryland. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. How are you, Aaron?
Fine. Go ahead.
So I have a question. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about if different oils are better for different cooking methods or temperatures, if you know anything or have any information about that, about, like, the burn points and how they react in the body differently at different temperatures.
Yeah, what's the smoke point we keep hearing about?
Well, the smoke point has something to do with the total amount of what we call free fatty acids in the oil. So we get free fatty acids in very unrefined oils, and a sort of mild kind of refining can be used to remove them. And once they're removed, then the smoke point gets very high. Those are molecules that evaporate and, you could say, pyrolyze. So they make smoke particles in the surface region right above the oil, and so you see smoke. Well, if you can remove those molecules, then you don't see that. So that's one of the important steps in the refining process.
Mm-hmm. And so which oils are good then for heating, you know, hot cooking?
Right. So it would have to be right. So it in principle, any oil could go through that process. But in practice, oils like peanut oil and soybean oil are refined so that they perform well in those kinds of applications, in frying applications, and also in high temperature, let's say, baking applications, which is less important for smoke points, but still important.
Do you like refined oils?
Most oils have to be refined in order to eat them at all. So it's not like we could get away from it completely or even mostly. But I think the right kind of refining I like, and so there's really some really awful kinds of refining that I don't like. How's that?
I won't ask you what they are. Should I?
No.
Oh, come on. Give us a hint.
Well, some kinds of refining really heat the oils to very high temperatures for very long times in order to drive off the flavor and the aroma, in order to make a nice fat that has no flavor for let's say shortening purposes. But that seems to change the chemical composition of the oil in ways that are probably not so good, and that we're only kind of really working out now. So I tend to stay with oils that have flavor.
Mm-hmm. No, that's like extra virgin olive oil. But I've heard that extra virgin, and I found this from cooking myself, is not a good oil to fry with because it has all those little particles, those molecules in it, because it's not been refined very much. Those cause the smoke.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's why if you're going to use extra virgin olive oil in a hot dish, you should have it on the table and put it on just before you eat. So you put your pasta on the table, it's hot and steaming, and you drop some oil on it right there. Mm-hmm. Also, some of these flavor compounds that are in extra virgin olive oil are affected in bad ways when you heat them to high temperatures in a frying pan, and they can get a bitter flavor to them.
Yeah, use it on your salads. Give us the last word on this, Tom. If you had to pick the healthiest oils, what would your top picks be? Give me a rundown.
Well, extra virgin olive oil is my favorite. I even have a few favorite trees over in Tuscany that make me happy.
Wait! I got to stop. You have the tree. You have it narrowed down to the tree.
Do you
go over there and get it yourself?
Of course I do.
Okay, I bought it. I bought it. I bet. Go ahead.
Very good. Good job. I think you stick with oils that have a lot of flavor to them. Lots of oils can fit that bill. I think probably virgin coconut oil is probably good stuff, particularly for vegetarians. Moderation in all things. Peanut oil, particularly for high temperature applications. Yes, for high temperature frying, you want to stir fry something, use some peanut oil. It performs very, very well, and it's made for that purpose.
And don't be afraid of the butter for baking.
Don't be afraid of butter. Don't be afraid of butter. And again, everything, moderation in all things.
Well, that's a good moderation in our segment. Thank you, Tom. We have to leave you now. This was very informative. Tom Brenner, professor of human nutrition at Cornell University. I think we have some tips for taking home this weekend. Thanks for joining us today.
Happy Psy frying.
Imagine it's summer vacation. You're on the beach under the umbrella. You have your SPF 50 on, don't you? Yes, shake your head. You've got that. You got the piña colada sweating in your hand. What's missing from this picture? How about a summer science beach read? Oh, yes. This hour, we're making a summer science reading list. We're collecting books about science, the environment, fiction, nonfiction, new, old. It is all fair game. And we've got a page turner for wherever your summer vacation takes you. And, you know, you can help us build this list. If you've got a science book, science fiction book to recommend, give us a call. 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. And, of course, you can tweet us at SciFry. Leave a message on our webpage at sciencefriday.com. or on our Facebook page. Joining me in the studio to share their top science reads are Lee Billings, an editor at Scientific American, author of the book 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's great to be here.
Also with us is Maria Popova. She is founder and editor of brainpickings.org. Maria.
Always a pleasure.
You have said the jackpot word, so I'm going to give you the first choice. What book is on the top of your list?
The first choice for me, by a long, long distance from everything else, is Dr. Oliver Sacks's autobiography, On the Move.
It's a great book.
Is a phenomenal book, and you've had Dr. Sacks on the show many times, and he is. Perhaps not only the world's most prominent neurologist, not only one of the greatest science writers of all time, but he's kind of a Henry David Thoreau of the mind. He explains, and in explaining, he enchants. And this book is not an autobiography in the strict sense. It's more of a dialogue with time on several simultaneous scales. There's the personal. We see him going from a world champion weightlifter to world-renowned neurologist. The cultural. He's a young gay man looking for love in the 1960s, very different than our post-DOMA world, and even the civilizational, his standing on the beach at City Island watching horseshoe crabs mate exactly as they did 400 million years ago on Earth's primordial seas. And I have to say, I don't say this lightly because I read a lot of books, dozens a month, but this has been one of the most profound reading experiences of my life, to which I came with reverence for Dr. Sachs's mind and work and left with just pure love for his spirit.
What a life he has led.
What a life.
And he's also a cephalopod groupie. So
he is indeed.
Yes. So he's we're celebrating Cephalopod Week this week, and he helped us celebrate it last year. Well, Lee, what is your top pick?
Oh, well, my top pick, I'm going to go with something a little lighter for summer reading to begin, and we'll get a little heavier as we go on. My top pick is actually something called Spurious Correlations, Correlation Does Not Equal Causation by Tyler Viggen. This is a book that you can read in an afternoon. You can read in a few hours, even if you want to, poolside, maybe with a pina colada in your hand. And it's basically just driving home the point through various humorous ways and examples that obviously correlation does not always equal causation. So he goes through and he gets all this authoritative data about various trends that have taken place over the years and compares them and finds some striking correlations that obviously don't have anything to do with each other, and some of them are humorous. So, for instance, he has potatoes used for frozen French fries versus instances of Garfield eating lasagna from 2000 to 2005. Those are correlated by about 96.9%.
No kidding.
Yeah, strange things like that. And then, you know, each one is kind of a cute, he gives cute background information for, you know, why some correlations may exist, why others are invalid. Or, you know, in undergraduate enrollment at U.S. universities versus injuries related to falling TVs from 2006 to 2010. That's a 99.6 correlation.
Stay away from those dorm windows is what he's saying. I'm Myra Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about what's to be on your summer reading list with Lee Billings and Maria Popova. Is there something, you know, a trend? I mean, well, let me ask it this way. What do you pick? How do you pick? Do you want a really relaxing book? Is that what you're looking for? Something that takes you away to some other place? Or are you looking to be informed? Like, you know, a geeky sort of book?
I personally don't have seasonality in my reading, so it doesn't really matter that it's summer reading. But I always look for books that, beyond the specificity of their subject, in this case the science, have a component of really kind of showing us how to live and ennobling somehow our lives.
And Lee, what's your preference?
I guess I spend a lot more time outside in the summer usually, and I'm walking around the world around me. And part of I guess summertime for me is good reading in the summertime is to actually kind of go to other places, go to other worlds, or better appreciate our own. So that's definitely where some of the other future picks are going to be coming in.
Let me see if I can get a listener pick in before we go to the break. Let's go to Kentucky. Henry in Kentucky. Hi, Henry.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Hey there. Go ahead.
The book is called Basin and Range. It's a rather old book. It's written by John McPhee, and it's a layman's guide to geology, especially plate tectonics that was coming in to vogue in the early 90s.
Yeah, Lee was giving a fist pump on that one.
It's a great book, one of the best.
Well, it should be good, but I'll tell you why we're reading it. I make a Western fishing trip every year with the same bunch of guys. And the fellow who's coming from Salt Lake, who lives in Salt Lake, suggested this book, and we're all going to read it and talk about it as we fish in the Seven Way Bitterroot Wilderness in Idaho for a week.
He's written some great books about geography. Wasn't it something Forming California, something Assembling California, right?
That's the one.
Yes.
That's a great book, too.
Yes.
Well, if you have time for both, good luck on your trip. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Bye.
He knows, and some fiction writers, you know, incorporate a lot of geology and science in their books. You know, Centennial, for example, talks all about Colorado's history.
Yeah. Well, I mean, John McPhee's books are just wonderful, and in particular, the whole geology sequence is wonderful because he kind of structures it as a trip across America from, you know, one coast to the other. So I think that this fellow on his fishing trip will have a wonderful time, especially as he's driving through the road cuts and things on the way to the Bitterroot.
Yeah, because there's a lot of those. Maria, a quick one, because we've got a few seconds before the break.
Speaking of fiction and forming nonfiction, I found this next book through Elizabeth Gilbert's novel, The Signature of All Things, which is about a woman botanist in the 19th century, but Gilbert mentions this amazing nonfiction book that came out about 12 years ago. It's called Gathering Moss by a bryologist, which if you don't, like me, know what that is a scientist who studies mosses, a bryologist named Robin Wall Kimmerer. And while the science itself is absolutely fascinating, what's really wonderful about the book is that in writing about moss, she's really writing about so much more, about the art of noticing, about living with presence. And speaking of Thoreau, if he was a poet and a philosopher who became a naturalist, she is a scientist who becomes a poet and philosopher.
All right, more books after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about your summer science reading list, drawing it up, getting a list of page turners for whatever and wherever your summer vacation takes you. We're talking with Maria Popova, founder and editor of BrainPickings.org, Lee Billings, editor covering space and physics at Scientific American. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me throw in a book of my own here. In the last year, there have been a few books that have blown me away, but I have to recommend The Lost City of Z by David Grant. It is amazing. It's stranger than fiction, and it's about searching for a lost city in South America that supposedly, you know, scientists and explorers for 100 years ago were looking for, and he sets out to see if there's any truth to all of this. And what he discovers is really amazing, and you can't put this book down, Lost City of Z by David Grant. Let's speaking of science fiction, you've got one, right?
Absolutely, I certainly do, Ira. I'm kind of recommending two books. I think you should read both of them. One is called Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson, is on shelves now. The other one is called Aurora by another science fiction author, Kim Stanley Robinson, which is coming out July 7th. And I think these two books are very interesting because they can be compared and contrasted, and you can get a lot about kind of the author's differing philosophies about the future of humanity and space flight and things like that by reading them. Each one is kind of almost a end of the world narrative, where in one case, in this case of Seven Eves, the moon is broken up into lots of different pieces that fall on Earth and essentially wreak havoc and kill most everybody, and they have to escape into space, the few survivors that can. And then Kim Stanley Robinson's Aurora instead is about a self-contained world, a generational starship that's on its way to another nearby star bearing potentially Earth-like planets. And it's telling the story of how this small microcosm of a world evolves over this journey, over centuries, and how the society and science takes place on it.
But the first book that you talk about, The Seven Eves, is really about something that's closer, sort of a spaceship or moon, so to speak, parts of the moon that blew up.
Right. I mean, they have much different, in Seven Eves, they don't actually go really much of anywhere besides just Earth orbit, you know, and they're building all these space stations to live in. And then obviously in the other case, in Aurora, they're going to another star. But both these books, I think, tackle very important questions about, it's not just hard science. It's also, again, how do you keep a society together in these extreme conditions, and how do people respond to them?
Small version of that would be The Martian, which is another, how one guy does it all for himself. Great read. Yes.
Speaking of keeping humans together in unusual environments, there's a very strange and wonderful book called The Antarctic Book of Cooking and Cleaning, which has many, many layers to it. As listeners might know, in 1914, Shackleton put a wanted ad in a London paper, and it said, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success." And apart from this being the most truthful advertising of all time, he got three women to apply, and they wrote this wonderful letter about how they would put themselves in any danger and wear men's clothes if they must. And he replied dryly, "There are no vacancies for the opposite sex on the expedition."
Oh.
Ouch. So fast forward 80 years, it's 1994, and two women, a humanitarian named Carol Devine and a cook, a chef, and visual artist named Wendy Trusler, set out on the journey that Shackleton denied those women, and they went essentially to Antarctica to clean up the enormous mess that we humans had made in the less than century that we'd been there. All the research stations and the garbage, you know, 80 years of mostly men on a frozen island.
Imagine what that looks like.
Yeah, exactly. It's a one large icy frat house.
A giant man cave, right, yeah.
And this book it has a lot of cultural history. It has beautiful excerpts from their travel journals from the expedition, and also a lot of recipes for the foods that Treusler cooked, many of which were, first of all, had at least three different cooking oils involved.
Right.
And it were inspired by the different national cuisines of the various research stations. It's a really wonderful book.
Having been to Antarctica, I can testify that there's a lot of junk lying around left over down there. I'm going to have to read that.
Yeah, and it was the first collaborative global environmental effort to clean up Antarctica.
We have some tweets that came in before. Ag science writer suggests the science of cheese by Tunick. Chemistry, biology, and physics plus cheese. What's not to like? Let's go to the phones to Eli in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Hi there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. How you doing?
Fine.
I have kind of a fun recommendation for a science fiction book. It's called The Lives of Tau by Wesley Chu. And it's essentially about this out-of-shape everyman who wakes up one morning and starts hearing these crazy voices in his head, and he thinks he's losing it. But then we soon discover that it's this guy, Tau, who's this ancient alien force who's essentially recruited him to become a secret agent to fight this war against this other clan of aliens. And it's just a really fun read, and seeing how this character develops to become a secret agent is kind of like James Bond in a way.
Wow, aliens fighting aliens. We've heard that theme before, right? That has happened before. Thanks for the suggestion. Your next one on your list.
Well, so another one in keeping with the science fiction vein, there's a book that came out in April that's called The Only Words That Are Worth Remembering by Jeffrey Rotter. And I feel like it didn't quite get a fair shake when it came out. I've been looking at the Amazon reviews, and I feel like a lot of people misunderstood this book. It was pitched, is it young adult? Is it humor? Is it satire? Is it serious? And it's kind of not any of those things. And it's a story of kind of I don't want to say post-apocalyptic, but a certainly dystopian future in America where a lot of science has essentially been forgotten. People, for instance, have even forgotten that the Earth is not the center of the universe. And Rotter builds this wonderful world. It's a cautionary tale, but he builds this wonderful world of, you know, what this kind of collapsed civilization looks like. And his characters running through it, have times where there are some hilarious pratfalls. There's also some real tragedies. It's kind of like a Clockwork Orange meets Huck Finn. Very, very nice book, though. And I think a lot of people misunderstood it when it came out, and I think more people should read it.
Yeah. Your choice, thanks.
I have the very opposite of that, a wonderful children's book by a British artist named Jenny Desmond. It's called The Blue Whale, and it is a kind of loving science lullaby for our planet's largest hearted creature.
Mm.
The heart of the blue whale alone weighs 1,300 pounds, and the whale itself about 160 tons, which is about 55 hippopotami, we learn in the book. But what's also very lovely is that the blue whale is one of the few creatures in the grand scheme of the biosphere with a lifespan almost identical to our own. And it's also all kinds of weird. The baby whales grow by 9 pounds an hour, and the whales don't really sleep. They do this thing called logging, which is floating very close to the surface, napping for short periods because they have to remember to breathe, which I thought was so lovely.
We have to remember. Yes. I want to throw in before I go to the phones. I want to throw in another. A surprisingly great book, and this is The Science of Interstellar. Kip Thorne, who was the scientist on the movie, he explains in great detail. I mean, it's a very entertaining book if you want to learn physics and enjoy the movie at the same time. Let me go to the phones. Our number is 844-724-8255. Let's go to Ariel in Royal Oak, Michigan. Hi there.
Hi, Ira. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Go ahead. Thank you.
I'm in the middle of a book called Euphoria by Lily King, and it's actually about these three researchers who are studying tribes in New Guinea. And so it's about this kind of love triangle that happens. But I think what's really interesting is how invested the book is in kind of this anthropological gaze that's being cast on these tribes, and how the characters' lives are mostly revolving around each other, but more so around these tribes that they're examining. and in turn how their lives are kind of molded by the tribes and their reactions to them versus the normalized like white codes that they previously prescribed to. So I just wanted to give that recommendation because I'm really enjoying it. Like I said, I'm about halfway through, so I thought I'd share.
All right. Thanks for calling. We'll have to put that on our list.
Another one that I'd like to talk about real quick is by Nick Lane. He's an evolutionary biologist, I believe, working in the UK, and it's called The Vital Question. It actually came out earlier in the UK, earlier this year, but it's coming out July 20th here in the US. And it's about, the subtitle is Energy Evolution and the Origin of Complex Life. So just real light reading for a summer day. What's really great about this book, though, is Nick does a great job of linking up energy with the origins of life. And he has this multi-branching, complex theory for why energy, in particular mitochondria, are really important for things like sex and aging. But I think the most important thing, the thing the book really does well, is it explains it kind of a really novel idea for the origins of life and fleshes it out very nicely that links life's origin and the origin of cells with hydrothermal vents that exist at the bottom of the ocean and these energy gradients that can be set up in the ocean water to mimic cellular conditions and kind of give everything else you need for the evolution of life. It's just a really beautiful synthesis of a lot of work that's happened recently and yeah, really, really, really good book. Highly recommended.
Mm-hmm. And Maria,
I have Einstein's God by Krista Tippett. She is the host of my other favorite public radio show, On Being, which is these long, wide-ranging, really wonderful conversations with all kinds of artists, writers, scientists, philosophers about basically what it means to be human in the world today. And this book is a collection of her interviews with scientists and science journalists on the relationship between science and spirituality, kind of trying to decondition our cultural reflex of seeing them as diametrically opposed.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255, or we're coming up with a lot of suggestions. We'll have all these suggestions up on our website at sciencefriday.com. And also, if you miss it, just listen to the podcast. You can hear it all over again and stop it when you want to write down the name of what you're hearing. Let's see if we can go to Al in Anchorage. Hi, Al. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you, Ira. Wonderful program.
Thank you.
The book I've got is Freeman Dyson's new book, published this year. Title is Dreams of Earth and Sky.
It's fantastic.
Excuse me.
Agreed.
Kind of dry out here. Dreams of Earth and Sky. I like the book for three reasons. The book is a collection of his reviews in the New York Review of Books from 2006 to 2014. So the reviews themselves are good reading. The reviews will put you on to the books and related books that he is writing about in the review. And the third reason is that whether you agree with Dyson or not on anything from string theory to global warming, his presentations in those reviews are calmly and well presented. No hysterics or histrionics. It's a very enjoyable read.
All right. Thanks for that suggestion. We're talking books this hour on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, with Maria Popova and also talking to Lee Billings. That's a familiar with that book?
Yes.
Great. You were saying it was a great book.
It's the contemporary counterpart to Stephen Jay Gould's I Have Landed, I would say, in terms of the writing and in terms of what it gives you and where it leads you.
He has some pretty wacky things to say sometimes.
He does, but he says them so beautifully. And Freeman Dyson is one of the interviews in the Krista Tippett book, by the way.
Is that right?
Yeah.
They call it Dysonian things. There's a meme for him for the kinds of things he talks about over the years. All right, in a couple of minutes left, give us another choice if you've got one.
Well, one that I have is Genius at Play, The Curious Mind of John Horton Conway by Siobhan Roberts. It comes out July 14th. And this is a biography of the mathematician John Horton Conway, who is best known for Conway's Game of Life, which is something that first appeared actually in the pages of Scientific American back in October 1970. And this is what's called a set of cellular automata, where essentially you have these little things on our grid that follow very, very, very simple rules. And from these simple rules, very complex behavior emerges. And so it's actually one of the first I mean, I don't want to call it a video game, but it's a very deep thing that has inspired a whole field of artificial life, and a lot of it is built up around around Conway's work. And what's nice about what Siobhan Roberts has done here is that he doesn't actually have any kind of archive or papers that he's kept. He's just kind of all over the place. So she's spent a lot of time with him, and it's basically just oral history and him spilling out his thoughts to
Interesting.
Her.
I want to jump in with a book we had last week. We had Ian Tattersall on, and he has a new book, The Strange Case of the Rickety Cossack and Other Cautionary Tales from Human Evolution. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but if you ever had trouble putting together the whole picture of Zinjanthropus, all these, you know, hominids and Australopithecus and all that, he puts it together in such simple form, shows you how it all fits in such easy-to-read language that it's the kind of thing that you could sit down and just, you know, page turn it. Because he talks about the mythology. He talks about how scientists work. It's sort of a personal, you know, relationship that he has with his work. And if you want to get it all straight, you know, if you think it's as hard to learn as quantum mechanics, it's not. He really lays it out very easily.
Where does the Cossack thing come in?
Well, they thought a rickety Cossack was actually a fossil, and it wasn't. It was a rickety Cossack. But it's a strange case of how scientists made all these mistakes over the years by looking at the fossils and mistaking them for other things. So, you know, it's an interesting title. Anyway, I got about a minute left. Any one book that looks great? Have you got one?
I have a compliment to Lee's sci-fi things. I have The Letters of Isaac Asimov, which include his fan mail to young Carl Sagan, in which he wrote, "You are my idea of a good writer because you have an unmannered style, and when I read what you write, I hear you talking."
Wow. Oh, yeah. Is science fiction, and you follow science fiction, are we done with the post-apocalyptic stuff now, or we have...
I don't think so. You know, and you had Neil on your show recently, Stevenson, of course, and he'd done this whole thing with the super optimistic sci-fi, and then, you know, his latest book, Seven Eves, destroys the planet. So I think we have a long, rich vein to mine in dystopia.
Well, we have a long, rich vein of books up on our website and the stuff that we've covered today on Science Friday. If you missed any of this stuff, as I say, go up to our website. It's sciencefriday.com. We'll have them all up there as fast as we can put them.
They're already up there.
They're already up there. And the new ones that you were suggesting, if you want to, you know, our listeners and what you talked about on this show, you can go to our podcast as it gets ready to go up there and listen to them again. Lee Maria, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lee Billings, editor at Scientific American, author of the book 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars. Another book, he won't promote it himself, but it's another great book. Maria Popova, founder and editor of brainpickings.org, and she really reviews such great books. Thank you both for being with us today. And as I say, you can see all of today's picks at sciencefriday.com. Head to sciencefriday.com/summerbooks. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And like a kraken rising from the deep, Cephalopod Week is back. We're celebrating all things tentacled, from the mighty giant squid to the humble nautilus. Join the party at cephalopodweek.tumblr.com. Chromatophores not required. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.